Hello. So, I know this isn't required, but I'm personally feeling a compulsion to finish chapter four. So, you can skip this section if, since you've already read it, if you like, or listen as you prefer. I will go ahead and skip footnotes though, and just read the main text. Synthetic freedom. While the left has traditionally been associated with ideals of equality, manifested today in the focus on income and wealth inequalities, we believe that freedom is an equally essential principle of left modernity. This concept has been central to the political battles fought throughout the 20th century, with the United States routinely posing as the, quote, free world, against a totalitarian enemy. In the figure of the USSR, and then the increasingly incoherent images of, quote, Islamofascism, unquote. In these hegemonic battles, capitalism has repeatedly asserted its superiority by upholding an idea of negative freedom. This is the freedom of individuals from arbitrary interference by other individuals, collectives, and institutions, paradigmatically, the state. Negative freedom's insistence on the absence of interference has made it an ideal tool to wield against purportedly totalitarian opponents. Yet it is woefully emaciated, yet it is a woefully emaciated concept of freedom. In practice, it translates into a modicum of political freedom from the state, ever less so in an age of digital spying and the war on terror, and the economic freedoms to sell our labor power and to choose between shiny new consumer goods. Under negative freedom, the rich and the poor are considered equally free, despite the obvious differences in their capacities to act. Negative freedom is entirely compatible with mass poverty, starvation, homelessness, unemployment, and inequality. It is also entirely compatible with our desires being manufactured and designed by pervasive advertising. Against this limited concept of freedom, we argue for a much more substantial version. Whereas negative freedom is concerned with assuring the formal right to avoid interference, quote, synthetic freedom, unquote, recognizes that a formal right without a material capacity is worthless. Under a democracy, for example, we are all formally free to run for political leadership. But without the financial and social resources to run a campaign, this is a meaningless freedom. Equally, we are all formally free to not take a job, but most of us are nevertheless practically forced into accepting whatever is on offer. In either case, various options may be theoretically available, but for all practical purposes are off the table. This reveals the significance of having the means to realize a formal right. And it is this emphasis on the means and capacities to act that is crucial for a leftist approach to freedom. As Marx and Engels wrote, quote, "It is possible to achieve real liberation only in the real world and by real means." Unquote. Understood in this way, freedom and power become intertwined. If power is the basic capacity to produce intended effects in someone or something else, then an increase in our ability to carry out our desires is simultaneously an increase in our freedom. The more capacity we have to act, the freer we are. One of the biggest indictments of capitalism is that it enables the freedom to act for only a vanishingly small few. A primary aim of a post-capitalist world would therefore be to maximize synthetic freedom, or, in other words, to enable the flourishing of all of humanity and the expansion of our collective horizons. Achieving this involves at least three different elements: the provision of the basic necessities of life, the expansion of social resources, and the development of technological capacities. Taken together, these form a synthetic freedom that is constructed rather than natural, a collective historical achievement rather than the result of simply leaving people be. Emancipation is thus not about detaching from the world and liberating a free soul, but instead a matter of constructing and cultivating the right attachments. In the first place, synthetic freedom entails the maximal provision of the basic resources needed for a meaningful life. Things like income, time, health, and education. Without these resources, most people are left formally, but not really, free. Understood in this way, rising global inequality is revealed as an equally massive disparity in freedom. One initial step in resolving this is the classic social democratic goal of providing the common goods of society, such as healthcare, housing, childcare, education, transport, and internet access. The liberal idea in which these basic necessities of life are supposedly enhanced by freedom of choice in the market ignores the actual financial and cognitive burdens involved in making such choices. In a world of synthetic freedom, high-quality public goods would be provided for us, leaving us to get on with our lives rather than worrying about which healthcare provider to go with. Beyond the social democratic imagination, however, lie two further essentials of existence: time and money. Free time is the basic condition for self-determination and the development of our capacities. Equally, synthetic freedom demands the provision of a basic income to all in order for them to be fully free. Such a policy not only provides the monetary resources for living under capitalism, but also makes possible an increase in free time. It provides us with the capacity to choose our lives. We can experiment and build unconventional lives, choosing to foster our cultural, intellectual, and physical sensibilities instead of blindly working to survive. Time and money therefore represent key components of freedom in any substantive sense. A full image of synthetic freedom must also seek to expand our capacities beyond what is currently possible. If it is to avoid the problem of manipulating people into contentment with the status quo, synthetic freedom must be open to whatever people might desire. That is to say, freedom cannot simply be equated with making existing options viable, but instead must be open to the largest possible set of options. In this, collective resources are essential. Processes of social reasoning, for instance, can enable common understandings of the world, creating a we in the process that has much greater powers to act than individuals alone. Equally, language is effectively cognitive scaffolding that enables us to leverage symbolic thought to expand our horizons. The development, deepening, and expansion of knowledge enable us to imagine and achieve capacities that are otherwise unattainable. As we acquire technical knowledge of our built environment and scientific knowledge of the natural world, and come to understand the fluid tendencies of the social world, we gain greater powers to act. As Louis Althusser put it, quote, "Just as knowledge of the laws of light has never prevented men from seeing, so knowledge of the laws that govern the development of societies does not prevent men from living, or take the place of labor, love, and struggle. On the contrary, knowledge of the laws of light has produced the glasses which have transformed men's sight, just as knowledge of the laws of social development has given rise to endeavors which have transformed and enlarged the horizon of human existence." End quote. The anti-intellectualism that permeates the political right, and increasingly infects the critical left, is therefore a retrogression of the worst kind. Healthy skepticism is transformed into an abdication of our commitments to expand freedom. This retrogression in relation to knowledge also occurs in the fantasies of immediate and unbound freedoms in practice. The volunteeristic image that sees mediations, institutions, and abstractions, as opposed to freedom, simply confuses the absence of artifice with the full expression of freedom. Needless to say, this is misguided. Collective action, with its expansion of synthetic freedom, is more often than not carried out through complex divisions of labor, mediated chains of engagement, and abstract institutional structures. The social aspect of synthetic freedom is therefore not a return to some human desire for face-to-face sociality and simple cooperation, but instead a call for collective, complex, and mediated self-determination. Finally, if we are to expand our capacities to act, the development of technology must play a central role. As has always been the case, quote, technology is the source of our options, and options are the basis of a future that keeps us above the level of pawn, unquote. Our level of freedom is highly dependent upon the historical conditions of scientific and technological development. The artifices that emerge from these fields both expand existing capacities for action and create entirely new ones in the process. The full development of synthetic freedom therefore requires a reconfiguration of the material world in accordance with the drive to expand our capacities for action. And if I just read that twice, pardon me, I paused and I don't know if I read that twice or not. Anyway, it demands experimentation with collective and technological augmentation and a spirit that refuses to accept any barrier as natural and inevitable. Cyborg augmentations, artificial life, synthetic biology, and technology-mediated reproduction are all examples of this elaboration. The overall aim must therefore be picked out. Sorry, motorcycle noises. I paused till I finished. But shoot, where was I? Possibly repeating a little bit. The overall aim must therefore be picked out as an unrelenting project to unbind the necessities of this world and transform them into materials for the further construction of freedom. Such an image of emancipation can never be satisfied with or condensed into a static society, but will instead continually strain beyond any limitations. Freedom is a synthetic enterprise, not a natural gift. Underlying this idea of emancipation is a vision of humanity as a transformative and constructible hypothesis, one that is built through theoretical and practical experimentation and elaboration. There is no authentic human essence to be realized, no harmonious unity to be returned to, no unalienated humanity obscured by false mediations, no organic wholeness to be achieved. Alienation is a mode of enablement, and humanity is an incomplete vector of transformation. What we are and what we can become are open-ended projects to be constructed in the course of time. As Sadie Plant puts it, quote, it's always been problematic to talk about the liberation of women because that presupposes that we know what women are. If both women and men have been organized into the forms we currently take, then we don't want to liberate what we are now, if you see what I mean. It's not a question of liberation so much as a question of evolution, or engineering. There's a gradual re-engineering of what it can be to be a woman, and we don't yet know what it is. We have to find out. End quote. What must therefore be articulated is a humanism that is not defined in advance. This is a project of self-realization, but one without a pre-established endpoint. It is only through undergoing the process of revision and construction that humanity can come to know itself. This means revising the human both theoretically and practically, engaging in new modes of being and new forms of sociality, as practical ramifications of making, quote, the human, unquote, explicit. It is to undertake an interventionist approach to the human that is opposed to those humanisms that protect a parochial image of the human at all costs. These interventions range from individual bodily experimentation to collective political mobilizations against restricted images of the human, and everything in between. It means liberating ourselves from the decrepit economic image of humanity that capitalist modernity has installed, and inventing a new humanity. Emancipation, under this vision, would therefore mean increasing the capacity of humanity to act according to whatever its desires might become. And universal emancipation would be the insistent and maximal extension of this goal to the entirety of our species. It is in this sense that universal emancipation lies at the heart of a modern left. We have seen that, without a conception of the future, the left becomes bound to a defense of tradition and to protecting bunkers of resistance. What, then, would a left modernity look like? It would be one that offered enticing and expansive visions of a better future. It would operate with a universal horizon, mobilize a substantial concept of freedom, and make use of the most advanced technologies in order to achieve its emancipatory goals. Rather than a Eurocentric view of the future, it would rely upon a global set of voices articulating and negotiating in practice what a common and plural future might be. Whether operating through slave revolts, worker struggles, anti-colonial uprisings, or women's movements, the critics of sedimented universalisms have always been essential agents in modernity's construction of the future. They are the ones who have continually revised, revolted, and created, quote, universalism from below, end quote. Yet to truly enable the liberation of futures in the plural, the current global order, premised on wage labor and capitalist accumulation, will need to be transcended first. A left modernity will, in other words, require building a post-capitalist and post-work platform upon which multiple ways of living could emerge and flourish. The next two chapters will set out both the necessity and desirability of this particular vision of the future.